according to our likeness. These curious things called male and female. Thank you so much. These curious things called male and female are the image and likeness of God in the world. So we talked about the male part of things, and this morning we're going to talk about the female part. And again, like we talked about last night, we're talking a bit more about the anthropological nature. What is the impact and what is the dynamic of the male within human society, within human civilization and the civilizing process? Now we're going to talk about women and the role that women play and their dynamic and how this is rooted in who women are and what women are. It's interesting, even as I'm just standing here speaking, it came back into my mind. We have Genesis 1, but in Genesis 2:18, it says, God says, it is not good for man to be alone. In Genesis 1, we have the creation of Adam and Eve together. In Genesis 2, we have the creation of Adam. God gives him work to do, naming the animals, things like that. But then God makes this observation, and he makes this observation before the fall, where he says, there is something that is not good. And now we, as good evangelicals, would say, oh, no, no, God, you're wrong, because everything that you do is good. You know, how could it be otherwise? How could God have created something and there be something in God's perfect creation that is not right? Well, God is, he's complex. And he's saying something is not good, and that thing that is not good is that the man is alone. God did not make a mistake. He's just saying, see Adam in his singular, solitary state? It is not good that he be alone. And now if you go to marriage conferences, they will say, the man was lonely. He needed somebody with him. And like, oh my goodness, no. That is a deep, deep anthropological statement about not that he's just lonely and he needs a bud. Yeah. It's that he is a relational creature, and not just he needs somebody to relate to, but like the Trinity, his nature is to commune. He is completed, if you will. The Son cannot be understood apart from the Father from the Son, right? Their essence cannot even be talked about or explored without a reference to the other. That's what God is saying, that man by himself is, if you will, a physical, psychological, emotional oddity. So he creates the solution to that problem. Think about this. Women, and it connects, guys, with what we were talking last night anthropologically. Thank you so much. Could you drink this and just make sure first of all? That we talked last night anthropologically kind of about the social problem of man. We're going to talk this morning about how woman is the answer to that. And God is saying, okay, I'm going to create this creature, and she is not just going to be your mate sexually or somebody to talk to during the day. She is going to be your completion, if you will. Right? And it's interesting, in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican in Rome, I've been there a couple of times, and I was able to sit. And if you've ever been there, they don't let you sit. You have to keep moving. So I wanted to just study. I mean, I'm there. Let me just take some time and study this amazing ceiling that goes from, you know, the beginning of time to, I think it goes up to Noah. But in the middle, if I were to ask you, what is the middle painting, the central fresco, if you will, in the middle of that ceiling, most of us would answer the creation of Adam. that finger thing, right? Because that's the most famous. It hit me as I'm looking, it's not. It's the next to the center, the creation of Adam. The middle of the story, the height of the story, is the creation of Eve. Michelangelo made it that way because he understood both his theology and his anthropology, that the creation of woman is the putting things before the fall, is the putting things right. She is the completion. And again, not just so that Adam has a sexual mate, or, you know, that he now has somebody to fix his breakfast, right? As many would think that's what Christians believe. No, she brings and puts humanity together. Therefore, it is now good. Because humanity, the two sides of God's image in the world, okay? So we need not only just a good theology of masculinity and femininity, but we need an anthropology as well. And that's what we're talking about. And that's what God is talking about in Genesis 2:18 in the bigger sense. Many times I think, you know, we'll get to heaven, and as good evangelicals, God will just say, I gave you this amazing word. I gave you this amazing story of what I was doing and what I'm about. And you guys just reduced it to just the simplest things. It's like taking a book of literature, you know, and like, don't you understand what this thing actually meant and how it impacted this later part of the story? Oh gosh, I thought that was just a guy with a wheelbarrow, you know? Like, no, that was something big. That's God's story, and we need to understand that, and we need to see that. So before we go on to talk about the woman thing, I need to tell you a story. And I wondered about telling this story. But, yes, last night we had violated the nice code of properness well enough, so I'm sometimes, like, when I wake up in the middle of the night, I'll watch YouTube videos of, and there's just millions of them on there, of news bloopers, like local news, right? And this was a real story. There was, the news reporter is saying, there was a bomb scare and a mass evacuation at the local Home Depot yesterday. And it was closed for a while, the fire trucks came, everything happened. And they found out, here's what happened. In the men's bathroom, okay, and this is, well, in the men's bathroom. Somebody had an experience in there, and they saw something, and they said something. So they went to the front desk, and they said, in the men's bathroom right now, there is a guy with a bomb, and he said he's going to detonate it. Okay? Serious thing. So evacuate, everybody's out. You know, now there's no bomb, there's nothing to be found. Nobody even knows kind of what the deal was. Well, they look into it, and the person who went up to the desk, do you know what I'm going to say? Because it was probably him. The way the news reporter reported it, and it was a woman, and she starts laughing, and she goes, you gave me this story intentionally, didn't you? She's reporting that what happened was, guys are in the bathroom, another guy comes in and says, you guys may want to head out, I'm about to drop a bomb in here. And I didn't get it at first. Somebody who has never been around teenage boys said, oh my goodness. I mean, isn't that just great? That's boy culture. That is even man culture, right? And it's funny because all of you ladies who laughed, you laughed because you have had or have teenage boys. If any of you, and this is serious, right? If any of you thought, you know, like, you have never been around guys. You guys better get out of here. I'm about to drop a bomb.
Isn't that wonderful?
In a bad sort of way. I'm the guy from Focus on the Family. I shouldn't tell stories like that. Okay. So the power of a woman, and it's interesting that I have this subtitle, The Sustained Freedom of a Nation. And I titled it that way because you're thinking, okay, the power of a woman connected to the freedom of a nation and the sustained freedom of a nation. Okay, let's see how he makes that connection. But as we're talking about this, keep in your mind what feminism is. And feminism, from its just bare fact, is a great thing. We're going to see in the second hour that Christianity is really the original feminism. So feminism, just straight down, the idea of the power and the value and the virtue of the woman is a very good thing. But how do we connect that to the sustained freedom and vibrancy of the nation itself? That is what genuine womanhood does. Now, most feminists would like, yes, exactly, the woman's march that happened, you know, earlier this week or last week, that's what we're about. But the point is, no, honey, call a radical feminist honey or gal. They like that. You know, no, that's not what this is about. So this is what we're going to talk about. And the subtitle here makes it even more interesting. Or the hand that wears nail polish rules the world. Feminists are not real big on nail polish. And I have a quote in here somewhere where Chesterton says that feminism is the pursuit of not being feminine in any way. That irony, right? Okay, so what we need to understand, and we're going back into the story, that first of all, let's look at the nature of sexuality. And from an anthropological point of view, we start with male and female, the differences in the natures of male and female. And the sexual exchange, the sexual negotiation it shows up like the first day of male and female. Our biblical story says that. God creates male and female. What does he call them to do? Not go start a business, not start a farm, not start a school, not start a church. He says, go forth and multiply. So think all the way back to biology class. He actually said to do something previous before multiplying. God, how do we do that? You know what? No, it just came naturally to them, right? And so sexuality, from the biblical point of view, is fundamental and foundational. The anthropologists would tell us the same thing. As men and women negotiate within a community, this is one of the biggest things that they'll have to negotiate. Not who gets the chicken wing or the turkey drumstick, you know, negotiating food, things like that. It's this. And first we have to understand that desire is not taught. Again, like with Adam and Eve, God said, you know, here's what you do with your sexuality. Multiply. Not, you know, here's that you have to do it. Adam recognizes that from the very beginning. Finally, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. God does not correct him and say, oh, good Lord, Adam, you had to go to the flesh part, right? Look at her spirit. Look at her sensibility. No. You know, God's like, yes, I made her that way so that they would both appeal to one another. So, sexual desire is not taught. It's very natural. Actually, sexual desire has to be limited and controlled. It has to be bridled. It has to be governed. That is, again, one of the first tasks of every civilization. How do we solve the problems that we've got to solve? Food is one, the equal distribution of that, things like that. But the sexual thing, what are we going to do with this very, very powerful and consequential thing. Okay? Limits must be taught and they must be enforced. So, the nature of human sexuality, again, is humans are relational creatures. We seek that out. Why are we? And the anthropologists tell us this. That goes back to our idea of man and woman creating the image of the Trinity. The fundamental nature of the Trinity is, we would think, holiness. No, it's relationalism. I mean, it's their construct. Holiness is a character of them, right? And that's important, but it's their relational nature. Next, humans are gendered creatures. And today we have this thing of, no, sex and gender are different things. Sex is what you are in your body. Gender is what you understand yourself to be. That's what you will learn on college campuses. We need to understand, and I wrote a piece for the Federalist a few weeks ago breaking this down. Is gender and sex the same thing? And what I did was I went back, and I didn't know this, but I went back to the etymology of the word gender. And gender, from the very beginning, it typically has been a grammatical kind of thing. We use gender. The two genders often will engage in sex. And so rather than the two sexes will all, you know, usually engage in sex. It's a literary kind of difference there. But we have to understand, think about the word gender. And this is what I found from, this is how it originated in language. Gender, generate, genesis. And even, and again, we're all adults here, the old English Oxford Dictionary talks about that, that it's also connected, the gender is also connected to gonad. It's the reproduction, it's what the male and female fundamentally just stripped down do. So gender is not about what we think about ourselves. That's completely made up, and it was made up by a guy named John Money in the late 50s, and then in feminism, it was taken on to mean, I'm female, but I can act in my gender in a masculine way. I mean, that has no rootedness in human use. It's gender is generativity, genesis, creation, and so that creation just speaks, bottom line, down and dirty, if you will, about male and female, that fundamental nature, the body parts, if you will, and their function. So sex and gender are the fundamentally, ontologically, the absolute same thing. We need to understand that. So humans are gendered creatures, male and female. There are only two options in the world. It's interesting that even the gender theorists cannot live consistently with their, oh, there's all kinds of genders. Find every single gender theorist, and if they've ever been involved in the birth of a baby, none of them have said, oh, you know, did you have a boy or a girl? Many of them will say, we're going to let the kid choose the gender. But none of them will say, oh, we had a whatever the ninth gender is. You know, they'll say, oh, it was a little boy, it was a little girl, right? So, this woman, Sylviane Agacinski, she is a feminist French philosopher. She is quite radical in some ways in that she's a leading feminist thinker, but she wrote a wonderful book called The Parity of the Sexes. It was published in 2001. Again, if you're a nerd on this, get her book, because she is talking about, as a feminist and as how we create law for there to be a parity, an equality between the sexes. She says from the very beginning, she says humankind does not exist outside the double form, masculine and feminine. The human species is divided into two, and like most other species, in two only. In other words, every individual who is not a man is a woman. There is no third possibility. And if she's speaking to a group of feminists, she's like, you know what? It's just a situation. You know, you can think it otherwise, but here's the bare facts on the ground. And so for us to understand that there are feminists who are just objective and factually rooted. There's another one, and I have a quote from her. No, I don't have a quote from her in the presentation. I'll give it to you now. Her name is Camille Paglia. And you should check her out on YouTube, because she's the feminist equivalent of Jordan Peterson. She's radical, she's a lesbian, but like she just says it. And she's like, yes, there's only two options, look around. And she says, the fundamental evolutionary nature of male and female, or humanity, is to procreate. It's the drive, it's why we are here today. And she says, as a lesbian, you know what? Gay relationships cannot deliver what humanity needs, just straight out. And she says this about male and female. One of the things is, she says, and others say this, is that the male of the species lives at the extremes, okay? For either good or bad. She says that the female of the species lives in kind of the safe middle. There are extreme women, and there are kind of safe in the middle men, but across the board, men tend to live out here. They're either this or they're this, okay? Women are kind of in the middle here, and she says this. She says, the reason that there are not many women Mozarts is because there are not many women Jack the Rippers. I mean, that's brilliant, right? And the other, and Jordan Peterson, I saw him making this comment to a feminist on Canadian TV. She was talking about how all jobs should have an equality of men and women in those jobs. And he just nailed her by saying this. You can say that because all you're thinking about are lawyers, politicians, CEOs of companies, and you just forget the rest of the workforce. So what you're saying is there should be a parity in the people who go around and clean portaleps. Men do that job. There should be parity in the number of coal miners that risk their lives and go down into the earth. Men do those jobs. And he just kept going on and on and on about these really kind of squat jobs that men do. And women are protected from by gentlemen. Like, so he's like, so sister, which way is it going to be? You know? Very, very good point. So, even the feminists agree that there are male and female. This is one of the most modest pictures that I could find about the, you know, the male and female Adam and Eve. That is the image of God. That is the story of humanity. Male and female are the only two models that come off the factory floor, you know, out into the world. The other is not just that humans are gendered creatures, but they are sexual creatures. And here's the thing, because they are sexual creatures, they have to consider one another. That may sound like, okay, whatever, but that is fundamental. The man has to, and this is what we're going to talk about today, the man has to consider himself a sexual creature as a man, and how do I operate in that? The woman has to do the same thing. Now, this is interesting because as you study this kind of stuff, you start to see it everywhere. Last night, I get the New Yorker. And so I'm flipping through the new New Yorker. And their cartoons are wonderful. Somebody had said about the New Yorker, it's the only magazine for people who don't necessarily read. You know, there's all these great cartoons. But you see this kind of thing, how men need to conduct themselves and how women need to conduct themselves. It was a three-part frame cartoon. And there's a man in one frame, there's a woman in another frame, and there's a bedroom with a bed in the third frame. And the man over here, his caption is, "Would you like to meet me in frame number three?" The woman says, "No, here's frame number three." What that is saying is, dude, that's not quite how you go about it, right? The man has to learn and live within himself. Even at the bar, last night, all over Billings, this negotiation is happening, right? And there's guys who are just like, "Honey, you know what? Look at me. Let's go." Okay? He struck out. He didn't negotiate himself well. He was not considerate of himself or the person that he was interested in. The guy who does it well, "You look beautiful tonight. Where, you know, tell me your story." Okay, he just wants to talk. Boom, you know. He's considerate of himself. He's not the hound dog, if you will, or comes, you know, right out as that hound dog. He has to consider himself. So again, that anthropological nature. And the woman as well, she has to consider herself how she plays that game. Women from the beginning of time play a little hard to get. You know, the woman who doesn't play hard to get is not the girl you want to take home to mom and dad, you know. The other is, and this is another piece that I wrote for the Federalist, what I try to do in my writing is to write not just news stories, but stories that are foundational, so that sex and gender, you know, that these are evergreen kind of articles that I can use in my work. You want to know what I have to say? Go to the Federalist, look for that sex and gender article. That sex is very, very consequential. And this was the title of my other article, "Sex is a Public Act." You know, the irony of that is, no, it's very private. What I mean is, it has very public consequences. In fact, in a way, it only has public consequences because it does not, you know, what happens in Las Vegas, this was a great line that I saw, it was a meme. What happens in Las Vegas is born in Billings, Montana 9 months later, you know? So, sex is a very, very public act. The other thing is sex bonds people and isolates people. The bonding is obvious, but it also isolates people. Think about this. And in terms of, you know, the feminist idea of parity, on the college campus, this thing called the walk of shame. Do both male and female take the walk of shame? That is a female thing because there is a female nature. The guy doesn't walk back to his dorm room and like, "Okay, I'm not going to tell the guys about this. Gosh, I'm so ashamed." Right? Quite the opposite. Okay? That speaks to the nature of female sexuality and male sexuality. It brings together the people who make the new people. And like we talked about last night, that's what marriage has always done, matrimony and husbandry. It connects the man who is not likely to settle down to the woman that he has impregnated. It settles him down. It ties him to that woman. Therefore, sex must be in every civilized society. In fact, it is the first civilizing action of any group of people, is the regulation of sexuality. Word good no. He is one of the leading early anthropologists of family, relationship, sexuality. I love just like the title of his book. There weren't marketers that helped him with that, but it's an academic book. Descriptions and Comparisons in Cultural Anthropology. This quote comes from page 8. And like I said, I read these things. I go see them in the context, make sure that they're good. He says, again, in all societies, scientists seldom speak in absolutes. They will use what we call weasel words, or, you know, make room for disagreement words. In most societies, in many societies, he says, and Margaret Mead last night in that quote, all societies, everywhere in the world, there is a need to determine who has sexual privileges, with whom, and on what occasions. The other side of that and is to determine who does not. Marriage takes women and men off of the sexual market. That's very, very important. Think about this. Even the roughest guys at a bar, okay, checking out the morning after, so how'd you do? Well, I went home with a married woman. Dude, you went home with a married woman? Do you have no shame? Okay, it's generally understood. She is not available. Nobody ever does that. Dude, you went home with a cohabiting woman? I mean, what kind of values do you have, right? Cohabiting does not necessarily take the woman off the market. For guys, the basic guy nature, you know what? She's still in play in some ways, right? He goes on to say, everywhere, finally, criteria of some kind are needed by which to determine where a child belongs, in what groups he has membership rights, and what adults are responsible for maintenance, socialization, education, and for the protecting of his interests and enforcing his rights. In a way, in the basic sense, marriage and confining sexuality says this child, it establishes paternity. And not just paternity. We think about that in our modern culture today. But what he was saying is this child belongs to this clan, this line of people, and this larger story. These aunts and uncles, these siblings, it puts the person within the legitimacy of their kinship. That's where we get the phrase illegitimate child. That is an anthropological judgment. It's not a, you know, oh, this is an illegal alien, like nobody's illegal, or every child is legitimate. It's not saying something about the quality of the child. It's saying, are they tucked in? Are they attached to the larger context of how they came into the world? And every society needs to determine that. If you do not have that, what do you need to do? And we're going to see this in just a minute. You need a welfare state, right? And that's not a judgment upon welfare people, but it's like, you know what? That's not really the way to go. And every person on welfare will tell you that quicker than anybody. I wish it were otherwise. Peterim Sorokin, he's a Russian scholar who came and founded one of the first sociology or anthropology departments, actually sociology, at Harvard. And he wrote a book, this is interesting, The American Sexual Revolution, written in 1956. The American Sexual Revolution did not start in the 60s. It got a boost of energy in the 60s. You look at people who study this, there was actually quite a vibrant sexual revolution in the United States in the 20s, the roaring 20s, the flapper, okay? Look that up if you don't know what that's about. Some of you might have been flappers way back when. He says in his book, the regime that confines sexuality with socially sanctioned marriage and that morally disapproves of and legally prohibits pre- and extramarital relations provides an environment for more favorable creative growth, okay? He is not necessarily a conservative. He is a guy that just observes society. Another guy, a British scholar, J.D. Unwin, said basically the same thing. When you look at all cultures, those cultures, and we're going to see this evidenced in a more recent study done at Penn State. They say when a culture has clear boundaries of here's where sexuality belongs, here's where it doesn't belong, and when it is confined within marriage, guess what? That society has more creative energy for ideas, for technology, for it, the energy, if you will, is focused better into making the society better than it is who am I going to score with tonight? Jay Leno said this. He said, many times in Hollywood, men are looking how to collect as many women as possible. He said, I'm married, I try to honor my marriage, so what I do is spend my time trying to collect as many cars as possible. Right? That energy has to go in a direction, right? You know, and again, he doesn't really know what he's saying, but he's saying something big and anthropological. So the question is that, first of all, we need to regulate sexuality. And it is women from the start that do regulate sexuality. Why are they so important to society? Not only do they bring forth the next generation, mothers, you know, like, what do you do? Well, I don't really do anything. I'm just raising my kids. Just raising my kids? You know what? What do you do? I run a small, lean, strategic factory of humanity. What do you do? Oh, I sell widgets. I'm sorry. You know, that's pretty awesome work, right? So, women regulate sexuality by determining which men will have access to which women, when, and under what circumstances. This is a foundational statement, okay? And women do this. Let me demonstrate this with the anthropologist. Again, this is Margaret Mead from the book I talked about last night. And again, this picture, she is in a world far different than ours. And she is learning this. She says, I love this because it relates to, get this, I mean, Hallmark movies, right? You know, all of you women are like, they're so wonderful. In the Hallmark movie, this is being done. In primitive societies, before marriage, it is the girl who decides whether she will or will not meet her lover, her potential mate, boyfriend, under the palm tree, or receive him with necessary precautions into her home or even into her bed. You know what? What happens there is all up to the whim. The whim of the woman. Here's what she says. He may woo and plead. He may send gifts, flowers, candy in our society, and pretty speeches by an intermediary. Okay? This is, you know what? Could you go see if Jennifer might be interested in me? You know? That's what we do early on. Yeah, she's pretty into you. Okay, now I'll approach. The guy has to muster up that courage, and many times he does it through an intermediary. It's interesting. Jackie and I met in high school, and I was a skater. I was a surfer, like I told you. I really wasn't in the game. And I would never approach a girl because I didn't want to be shot down. My buddies came to me. He's like, dude, she's really into you. Really? Like, oh, yeah, ask her out. She'll say yes, you know? Is I would only go in that which was safe. Speeches by an intermediary, but the final choice remains in the hands of a girl. Get that. She is the determiner. Do not pass go, or yes, pass go. Okay? She is the red, green light, yellow light. And this is the great thing. A mood, a whim, a slight disinclination, and the boy is disappointed. But in marriage, all of this changes. In marriage, there is the equalizing. You know what? I've let you through the gate, metaphorically and literally, you know, and now, you know, you can be comfortable. A slight whim in primitive cultures, it's that way everywhere. And it's like, you know, a guy will say to another guy, like, dude, you got to read the signs. You know, you jumped some of the signs there. There's these subtle signs of a woman. On YouTube, guys can go find videos how to tell if a girl is into you. And they will say, I mean, literally, if she does her hair, if she reveals her neck to you, you know, it's like, dude. But you think about that naturally. She is like, an animal does not show his neck or her neck, you know, to an opponent. That is a very kind of vulnerable, exactly, you know, or she plays with her hair. I was talking with a woman at work. She's going through cancer treatment. She has finished her chemo, a big, big thing to her, and she spent a lot of extra money that she does not have to try to keep her hair going through chemo. And it struck me like, it's just hair. But no, a woman's hair is her honor and her crown. You know, she's playing with her hair like, I'm comfortable with you. There are those cues that women have been sending from the beginning of time. And they're clear to women because a guy's girlfriends were like, dude, it's obvious. He's like, not obvious to me. Are you kidding me? You know, women can see that kind of thing. Even if another woman is a little more subtle, other women will say, you slut. You know, like, good Lord, you're too forward. And guys are again like, I don't know what's going on. What Margaret Mead is telling us is that these things happen across. There is this dynamic. There is this negotiation. There is this sending of the messages. The guy in frame one says, want to go to meet me in frame three? You know, she's like, no, try a little bit harder in that way. And this is it. Men who take sex by physical power are seen in every single human culture the same. In no culture are they idealized either by the male or the female. Think about that. In the locker room, dude, I was with somebody last night and I just took what I wanted. There are some guys who like, you know what, good for you. Most of the other guys like, you're an idiot. And the guy who just, you know, fist bumped you, he's an idiot. Like, no, guys don't act that way, right? In no society, the caveman who goes and grabs the woman and drags her, that's a fiction. Men from the beginning of time have had to woo the woman, have had to bring gifts, have had to basically, like in marriage, kneel down, submit himself to her sexual nature, as we're going to see. What'd you guys do Saturday morning? We talked about sex the whole time. This is a wonderful book. This is by Donald Brown. He teaches he's retired now, but at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is studying human universals. What is it that we see in all civilizations throughout all times that are common? Music, dancing, jokes, humor, you know, he says this, sex is seen as a service given by females to males, females being the limiting source. A young woman acting coy or flirting with her eyes, very subtle, does it in a way you would recognize quite clearly. In all human civilizations. So, women control the sexual economy. Brown's quote, women being the limiting source, they set the market price. Okay, this I love. This guy, Roy Baumeister, he was at Florida State, now he's gone on to teach in New Zealand. But he writes this wonderful essay published in the Personality of Social Psychology Review. Sex economics, sex as female resource for social exchange in heterosexual interactions. What he's saying is, you know, we don't think of sex and economics, but economics is the study of desired goods. And all desired goods are negotiated, you know? And cartels, if you will, set the price. If you want our gas, here's how much it costs. And largely across the board, everybody is going to be charging that price. They're setting the price. Women, ideally, by having high ideals for sexuality, you know what? You want access to me? Here's what I want. I want a ring. I want you to ask me a question. We're going to go. I'm going to introduce you to my family. We're going to have a big party. You're going to commit yourself to me. And after that, then you have access to me. She sets a very high price. What we have today is the hookup culture at the party. This intoxicated guy is interested in me. I think he's going to be the best I'm able to get. Sure, whatever. I mean, that's basically, I'm selling gas at my gas station. I don't think people are actually going to pay a decent price. So, you know what? Pay whatever you want. That's not how the market works that way, but it's how the sexual market is working today. Let me just read you this quote. The initiation of the sexual relationship corresponds to a transaction in which men offer women resources in exchange for sex. Again, even at bars, that is what is happening. The phrase, at least buy me dinner first, you know, that's kind of a joke of, at least I want something. In general, the data suggests that male sexuality has no or little exchange value. He can't even give it away. You know what, ladies? Here I am. Line up. Right? Yeah, I don't think so. Men and women's sexuality are valued differently, and these differences will organize the behavior of most individuals in society. Okay? That it drives what happens in society, the price that women put on sexuality. And again, like we talked about last night, marriage makes men better. When women say, here's the price, no negotiations, you pay this price, when the man does that and steps up, he is a better man. He is more respectful, he's more honoring. Cohabiting men do not act like married men. My book, The Ring Makes All the Difference, talks about that. Cohabitation does not make the man like, okay, I've got to start acting differently here. Actually, quite the opposite. Honey, we ain't married. You know, stop with your demands. The husband does not, he cannot say that. Happy wife, happy life, right? You know, can you say cartel? That's market dynamics in the gender win and loss. That is, women do well when they set a high price. Let me say this. Marriage, and this is important. This is anthropological. It's moral, but it's not just moral. Marriage is the relationship on the woman's terms, matrimony. Cohabitation and hookups are the relationship on the guy's terms. I get this very valuable good for rock bottom prices. Hookup is the Walmartization, if you will, of sexuality. Low prices every day. Marriage is, no, you're gonna pay my price, and if you can't pay my price, keep walking, okay? We've got about 8 minutes. Okay, this is an interesting study, and this is what one of the things that I was referring to earlier. This study came out, Academic Journal, 2009. These people are from the Wharton School, business people. It is, how is woman's happiness doing today after the feminist movement. The paradox of declining female happiness. Yet we show that measures of subjective well-being indicate women's happiness has declined both absolutely and relative to men. As women have advanced, as women have gotten more opportunities, that's not what's making them not happy. It's that their sexuality, as they have given themselves away, started to act more like men. You know what? We're not getting what we want, and that is connection with a good man who will settle himself down. Interesting. We also find, this bottom quote, we also find the relative decline in women's well-being is ubiquitous. That means it happens everywhere. And at the end of the article, they ask the question, why is this so? And they offer a number of theories. They're only theories, they don't know. But they say finally, which is, this is our last conclusion. This is the last thing we want to leave with you. These are, you know, general run-of-the-mill sociologists. They say finally, the changes brought about through the women's movement may have decreased women's happiness. That's stunning that they recognize that, right? Because somehow encouraging women to act and play on the sexual field, the work field, the business field, more like men, maybe that hasn't been so good for women to deny their very nature, right? What shapes men for the better? I want to tell you this story. This is very important. Gail Collins, she is one of the editorial page editors for the New York Times. She's been there forever. She is not a conservative by any stretch. She wrote a wonderful book called America's Women. And this is how women shaped American culture. And these are not like Dolly Madison's and the famous. This is everyday run-of-the-mill women, how they affected the establishment and the building of America. Early on, she tells, in the first couple of pages, she tells the story of Sir Thomas Dale in Jamestown, 1611. She says that the mother country, as the when they came to America, it was a business effort. It was a business outreach to come colonize, subdue the Americas, and start sending goods back to the mother country. So they sent men over to do this. What they found out was the first year, the second year, those men were not sending goods back to the mother country. They were sending nothing back. So they sent Sir Thomas Dale over, go over there, find out what's the deal. And she is telling this story, okay? She says his note back, and I love it because she uses the actual spelling, how he worked. This is what these guys are doing. They are engaged in their daily and usual works, which was not work. It was bowling in the street. Yeah, we'll work tomorrow. We'll get to it tomorrow. Okay? So what did they do? Here's the other thing that they found. Collins reports that the women... Let me back up. What they did, what the mother country did was said, well, let's try sending women over there. And let's see maybe if they will have an impact. They knew they would have an impact. You know what? The guys are not going to say to the women, we'll get to it tomorrow. Here's what women do. Yes, ma'am. You know, women have always been doing that, right? And think about that as a person can get a whole bunch of men to do what men need to do without saying a word. That's power, right? You know, to their girlfriends, watch this. You know? Feminists do not do that. They bark, they yell, they have to exert energy to try to get the men to do what they want them to do. Nice, feminine woman, she just has to do like this, or like, you know? So, she says that what they, you know, this gentleman found, he said, or these women, they must have found themselves marooned in what seemed like a long, rowdy fraternity party, minus the food. It's interesting that she uses that picture of the fraternity party. You go to a fraternity and the men are like, Sir Frank, thank you for coming tonight. The drinks are served over in the, and you look very nice tonight. You know, men left to men don't tend to act that way. The napkin exists. Think about this. The napkin exists because women exist. Right? And the napkin is an indicator of manners, of refinement. Okay? 2 minutes. I'm going to run through this. This study right here, I'm not going to go into this, but this was a study in 2012. These scholars, the puzzle of monogamous marriage. And what they said is if men make the laws and men in developing societies are, you know, their sexuality is enhanced and their desire is for diversity and opportunism, why is monogamy becoming the norm? They call it normative monogamy. Why is that becoming the norm in all industrialized society? And here's what they say. They say, I'll go through this real quick. Normative monogamy reduces crimes, including rape, murder, assault, robbery, and fraud, as well as decreasing personal abuses. By assuaging competition for younger brides, normative monogamy, meaning that's the expectation that all of us have, decreases the inequality to females in many important measures. By shifting male efforts to compete and collect as many women as possible, and the guys who don't have as much to offer, they have to go take what they want because they're shut out of the market. By shifting male efforts from seeking wives to paternal investment, normative monogamy increases savings, child investment, and economic productivity, and it protects the women. Women do well in monogamous cultures. You look at these documentaries on polygamous sex in the West, those women are not strong, independent women, right? So, what shapes men for the better? The expectations of women. Women do, and they do it through marriage and domesticity. I have another essay that I wrote a number of years ago on Rosie the Riveter. Okay, Rosie the Riveter, and you guys know this, Rosie the Riveter is seen as the feminist champion. But Rosie the Riveter, she was strong. She came in, she saved America. Let's put ourselves into the problem that we have while our men are gone. But they were wives. They were mothers. They were saying, our men are off. Let's come up and let's support them. Let's support our country. She was inherently domestic. She was not a radical. And in fact, I go into that poster, that famous poster. It was a Westinghouse poster simply to motivate their employees. It's a fascinating history to look at. And so this article, Rosie the Riveter at the Federalist, if you're interested in that. This is George Gilder, his book, Men and Marriage. And I'm going to end with this. Once the man marries, he can change. He has to change. For his wife will not long have him if he remains in the spirit of a single man. You know what, honey? Going out with the buddies. Oh, that's what you want me to do? Sorry, going out with the buddies. I like to say this, and you know, when I speak on secular campuses, they'll say, well, in your community, the man rules with an iron fist, and the women just have to salute and say, yes, sir, whatever you say. And I say, in a sense, That's just absolutely wrong in a big sense. And I'll say, Dr. Dobson, you know who wears the pants in his family? Shirley does. And you know Jim Daly, who wears the pants in his family? Gene does. And of course, Doc and Jim are the heads of their family. The buck stops with them, but not in power, but in responsibility, right? How do we know that Gene and Shirley, thank you, wear the pants in the family? Here's what I say. Who determines what you and the family do on Saturday? You guys here? What are we doing on Saturday? Well, I want to go to a lecture at a hotel conference room. And the gentleman, like, okay, I was going to go do this, but yes, ma'am. Right? Who is it that determines with the freedom of the family what is going to happen? The man, in a way, has to ask permission. That is power. Honey, is it okay if I go golfing? The good wife says, you know what? Yeah, you need that. Go ahead and do that. You know what? Can I go fishing? Yeah, that's fine. He's not asking permission like a little boy, but he is submitting himself to her management, if you will, of the home. It's not a power game. But it's interesting. The feminists make it about power. People like us, we know how to negotiate. We know the warp and woof, if you will, of the economy between the man and the woman. The angry feminists are like, you know, they have to demand what they want rather than in that relationship negotiate. He must exchange the moral and spiritual rhythms of the hunt for a higher, more extended mode of sexual life. He must submit ethically and sexually, this is huge, to the values of maternal morality and futurity. That is what I've been saying all along. The woman controlling sexuality, she is long-term. She is long-term. Her sexuality, her procreation is focused on the future. Remember what I said last night, Jackie? We're going to have kids one day. I want those kids to grow up in a house. I want that house to be owned by us. She's thinking long-term. I'm not. I'm thinking about dinner tonight. You know, quite literally, right? So it is the classicalness, if you will, of female sexuality and its demands and its needs which create civilization. So ladies, what do? You're not just, you know, okay, I'm this controlling individual that says, no, I have a headache tonight, or no, I'm not willing to go over to frame number 3 with you. It's, I want you to act in a higher level, in a higher kind of way. And by my expectations and my determinations, I'm not just going to make you a better man. I'm going to make this community a better place. That's what the New York Times editorialist was saying, that America exists because women came in and made demands. And men followed those demands. It's 10:06, 10 minutes. Then we're going to come back and we're going to finish up by looking at the problems of modern feminism.